The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast, where we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me still here, it's James Batchelor.
I'm still here.
Still here.
I'm still here. Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. Yes. I've had a bit of a busy week. I haven't really been here too much. I was frantically doing some research for this podcast about 10 minutes before we went live. So let's talk about last minute.
But, so what have you been up to this week then?
I've been in Morocco.
Oh, yes, of course you have. You've been driving my diesel Mazda around, haven't you?
Well, not specifically your car, because hopefully you haven't lost it. But I was doing one of Mazda's epic drives. They do these every year, and they choose an extreme place where, you know, it's unusual for a car to be sort of launched or driven or something. And it's just a sensational event. So this year it was the Mazda 660 diesel, and we did 1,100 kilometers in 2 days, which I know doesn't sound a huge amount, but the starting point was in Marrakesh, and we climbed up over the Atlas Mountains on some of these roads. I mean, really, you needed like a proper Jeep Wrangler with off-road tires to cope with these roads. But no, we had these 660s with summer tires on, and we went through Dardez Gorge, which is just a sensational place. And we went on the highest road in Morocco and over the course of 2 days. And it was sensational. Although I have to say, I've come back and I'm feeling a little bit ill from it, which I'm just saying this just to get a bit of sympathy from our guest, who we will introduce momentarily. But I've got what they crudely call Deli Belly. I might need to run to the lavatory at some point during this podcast. I'll let you know.
Okay. Well, I mean, you could have avoided all this by having a Mazda Epic Drive in Kettering, which is a facility that I would have provided for you. I'll give you a lovely driving route down the A14 in any direction. You could go either way. Doesn't really matter.
That would be a mediocre drive, wouldn't it?
I mean,
Mazda's
mediocre
drives.
I've also had an epic drive. Do you want to ask me where I've been?
Where have you been, John?
Acton. It's I mean, if you haven't been, there's never a bad time to go to Acton. But on this occasion, I have to regale you with a tale of why I've gone to Acton. And it's because I've been told I need to update everyone on the extremely interesting tale of the Skoda Fabia, which apparently we haven't talked about for some time. So people are dying to know whether it has sold. It has sold. So James sold it just before his operation to a lovely young lady who lives in West London. So it went up there to live. Unfortunately, since then, just after James had his operation, three or four of the cars that he bought went wrong. So just as he was lying there, half asleep, half on drugs, whatever, Paul Becker was dealing with all these people going, my car's broken. So one of them was the Skoda, which had a slightly dodgy boot opening mechanism that, you know, i.e. it wouldn't open. So this person that had bought it put their Alsatian in the back and then couldn't get the Alsatian out, which is slightly awkward. So I was dispatched to West London to go and get this lovely Skoda Fabia and drive it all the way down to Gosport, have it fixed and take it back again. So that's my new job. I'm the delivery driver.
Who thought selling used cars was easy, eh?
Well, I think
literally
until last week, I think we did. But it's all gone a bit Pete Tong since then. But anyway, that's all resolved now, so I will move us on from that tale of woe and introduce our guest. So our guest this week, I'm thrilled to say, is Head of Valuations at CapHPI, Darren Martin. Darren, lovely to see you.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, despite having gone to West London.
Well, it's all about the after-sales care, isn't it? So hopefully she'll be grateful and your reputation is intact, and it's how you deal with people when things go wrong. Next, things will go wrong. So sounds like you've done the right thing.
Also, I apologise here, Darren. I think John accidentally demoted you there. I think you're director of valuations.
Oh, sorry.
Not head of valuations.
Yeah, it's fine. What's in the title? It doesn't.
I'll reintroduce you. Director of Valuations, Darren Martin. Darren, lovely to see you.
Yeah, I'll put you back on the list for maybe going to win now then, John.
Oh, no.
You're off the list for a while.
I think that's a bit broken. So just give us a bit of we couldn't have you on without immediately asking. Tell us what's going on at the minute. Give us a bit of an overview. I mean, we're ahead of your next publication date here. So, I mean, if you want to give us any tasty morsels from where we are at the minute.
Easter period was, I think, it was relatively strong for dealers. I think it might have dipped off a little bit over the last sort of week or so from conversations we're having. It's plenty of data. We've actually saw more sold data over the Easter period than pre-COVID Easter. So that's good. It's been a good year so far, actually, for the used car market. A strong first quarter. Values went up around 0.5% over those sort of 3 months. So ebbs and flows, and obviously lots within the averages there. But within our Cap Live product so far this month, there has been a drop. We've seen conversion rates down, more volume obviously coming back into the market. And I think the reason why values are dropping is because of more volume rather than a drop off in demand. Obviously, March new plate generates more cars. So at the moment, we're just under 1.5% down. But that's fairly normal for this time of year. Once you get Easter out of the way, you're getting into holidays, and then you get into bank holidays in May. And it's probably one of the weaker sort of periods of most years. It feels as though we're getting into a more seasonal sort of pattern again, like pre-COVID. We've obviously had some very unusual years. So yeah, it's all pretty positive despite that drop. We'll probably end up at about 1.5% down on average. The big fly in the ointment, as has been for what, 18 months, 2 years, is electric vehicles. And we're still seeing a lot of volatility in the electric vehicle market. I think the biggest drop we've made this month is a 13% drop, which is obviously pretty major. We're seeing some weak values on certain EVs. Others continue to hold relatively firm. It's just really, really mixed. And so it's very difficult to predict what happens there. You've got the ZEV mandate, which with new car pushes, we see lots of new car, heavy new car discounting. Still, it's difficult to say why would a used buyer buy an EV unless it's now on price. Prices have come down. Still some work for the government to do, in our opinion, with regards to sort of VAT on charging not at home, which is to sort of help with that. So yeah, it's a good market overall, but definitely some issues in that EV world.
Is there still a lot of pressure on those high-end EVs? Because I could imagine at the budget end, it's kind of, you know, prices I would assume have sort of leveled out a little bit, but at the high end, these cars are starting to look a bit expensive.
It's not necessarily just at the high end, because if you think about that low end, because other cars, like for Tesla, for example, you now see Teslas around the £20,000 mark. So they've kind of squeezed that bottom end a little bit. So there is still some pressure on some of that lower end cars, like the Leaf, like the Golf, for example. I mean, you can get a Golf EV for 11 grand at 3 years old. That's cracking value, but it's still fairly low range. And if you're now looking for a used car at that sort of level, you maybe think, well, I can pay a little bit more. I'm in a Tesla Model 3. I'm in something a little bit more aspirational. So yeah, the top end is affected. It's those sort of models that came in and maybe didn't drop so quickly that are now hitting the market in more volume from various sources that we're seeing a little bit weak. So it continues to be amongst all of the price ranges, really. So It's a difficult one to sort of say this is what's happening to EV values because it's just so mixed. As I say, a 13% drop, that's by no means across the board, but it is for a particular model where we're seeing a lot of weak data, a lot of weak sold data.
Okay,
So it's very much a
interesting.
model-specific situation still, isn't it, then?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Just doesn't make life very easy when you're trying to buy EVs.
No, there's some definite opportunities with EVs, and we've done some analysis on the retail data that we have that shows that I think it was around 17% of independents have actually advertised an EV in the last 6 months. So that's quite low, and it's only around half of franchise dealers have actually advertised one. So it's still not wide scale enough, but there are some cheap cars there and some good profit opportunities. And we obviously track our cap clean value to the retail values as well, and you can see some good profit opportunities. But I think that it's probably a bit of caution and make sure you're buying the right models, tracking what's happening in the market, and probably not buying too many of them. Just dip your toe in to start off with and see how you get on.
How are hybrids and plug-in hybrids doing at the minute? Because that seemed to reach a little bit of volatility recently.
Yeah, it's petrol cars that are going the best without a shadow of a doubt. So when values have dropped by 1.3%, petrol cars have dropped by less than 1% on average. So they remain the go that remains the go-to fuel type. Hybrids dropped sort of in line with that average, 1.5%. Plug-in hybrids, 1.2%. So yeah, they're dropping by slightly more. They've been a little bit more volatile as they kind of rearrange themselves price-wise over the last few weeks and months as well. But this month, probably a little bit more stable, certainly more stable than electric cars. So it remains that sort of halfway house and remains quite popular to buy a plug-in or a hybrid. It's just that electric vehicle is a bit of a leap of faith still. Demand's gone up. No doubt demand has gone up and will continue to do so, but obviously volumes are going up as well. And the manufacturers have got a real challenge going on with the ZEV mandate. And most of those cars in the new car market are going into fleets. So they're going to come back from fleet companies on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, I feel as though we're going to be talking a little bit about that in one of our stories a little bit later on. But of course, we're going to be speaking to you next week, aren't we, Darren, for the full
Yeah, we'll give
once
you
you
a full update
publish,
then.
we'll
Yeah.
do a full Car Dealer Live or a full interview with you. So look, very much looking forward to that.
Okie doke. Well, I shall get us to crack on with our stories then, as I'm sure we'll talk more about values and so on. So Batch and I are going to run through our favourite stories of the week. And at the end, Darren gets to decide which one of us chose the best stories and who is the winner. I'm going to say that I won last week, Batch, because it sounded like Jack changed his mind at the end. I don't know if you
You
remember.
did. You did win. It's fine. I'm not bitter
Thank you.
much.
Okay, so I'm going to start. I'm going to start with, unsurprisingly, Inchcape. So, rather irritatingly, they announced this on Monday, which is quite far away from our podcast. So there's us talking away about, I want to say, AutoNation potentially buying them last week, and then 3 days later, oh no, AutoNation have not bought them. Group One Automotive have swooped in. And I feel a little bit embarrassed for not really seeing that coming, because Group One obviously has a presence here and have had a presence here since 2007. And when you actually look at the two companies, there is a bit of alignment in terms of how it all slots together. But anyway, I'll come on to that in a minute. So the general thrust of the story is they've sold for 346 million. So I should say this is Inchcape's retail sites in the UK, of course. Inchcape being an enormous company, it does lots of other different things. I think this actually gets rid of their retail part of their business almost entirely. I think they might have some retailers still in like Poland or somewhere, but generally speaking, they've disposed of a lot of retail sites over the last few years. So this sort of pivots Inchcape to the back to being an enormous distributor and various other service product provider for automotive, but not really retail anymore. So 346 million, as I say. Shareholders are getting 100 million of that via share buybacks and so on. I won't go into all the various complications of money and so on. But what I thought was really interesting about this is if you have a look at, well, there's a couple of things that are interesting. If you have a look at Group One's map of the UK as to where they are, and have a look at Inchcape's map and, you know, overlay them in your mind of where all their sites are. This is actually a really good fit for Group 1. Group 1 tends to be more sort of southeast home counties. I think they go as far north as King's Lynn. But they don't really have much over, let's say, the west side of the M1. Whereas Inchcape do. Inchcape go all the way up to Manchester and the northwest. I think they've got stuff much further west in general. They do have some stuff in the east as well. But generally speaking, this sort of completes the map of England, certainly not the UK. They don't have anything in Scotland either of them. But it's a really good fit for them. I think the brands they represent also pretty similar. So I think that's pretty good. And of course, they're here already, aren't they? So it's much easier for them to take this on than a company like AutoNation, who would have to suddenly get to grips with the UK market. So I thought that was really interesting. The second point is, where does this leave AutoNation? Because they've now bid for two different, that we know of, bid for two different dealer groups and have lost. They've got to be, you know, desperate for attempt three, you would think. They've obviously got the money ready. They're desperate to do it. Where are they going to go next?
Virtue.
Excellent. We'll move on
Virtue.
Then.
Perhaps they'll go to Virtue. Well, it's the only one left, isn't it, really? I mean,
pretty much, yeah. Go on, Batch. What did you think?
Well, firstly, I don't think you should. I think you're beating yourself up for not spotting this coming, because neither did I, actually. And when I read this story deep in the Sahara Desert, it did take me by surprise, because I didn't really see it coming either. I have to say, it sort of marks a bit of a real sort of, attempt by Group One to really put their stamp on the UK, because it's only been a couple of years since Group One have sort of really collated everything together and have called themselves Group One, because, of course, they've owned various businesses and dealer groups in the UK, but they all sort of ran under their original names. I mean, the one that's sort of local to me is Barron's, which had BMW Mini dealerships. And then all of a sudden, sort of practically overnight, you know, it became a Group One operation. So I think this is the sort of the next big step for Group One, where they're really, you know, are on the acquisition road and want to really strengthen their operations. So it's an interesting deal. I agree, and I'm going to sort of roll two stories into one here, I'm afraid, because
I also had
this story on my list. The other story I had on my list is that our learned colleague who was on the podcast last week, Jack Williams, has written a big feature about why the UK is such an appealing prospect for US investors. And to sort of give you the top line, really, it's a good exchange rate, it's competitive pricing, and it's operational strength. I mean, these are the things that are attracting US investors to UK dealer groups. I do urge people to go and read this, because it's a very chunky feature, but Jack has spoken to some really, you know, top experts in the financial sector to see. He sort of probed why this is happening. So, yeah, it's a very interesting outcome. But again, it's another sale of a UK dealer group, and the pickings for other companies to buy UK dealer groups is just got that little bit smaller now, hasn't it?
Darren, what did you make of this?
Yeah, I think the follow-up story is a really interesting one, because, you know, undoubtedly we'll see more US investment coming over, and I think Group One, I think you're right, they're probably not nationally known, or not, you know, by the consumer. We're obviously very close to it, so we in the industry kind of heard of them, but yeah, you're starting to see more and more of them around, and I wasn't aware of that sort of map that you talked about, John. That is really interesting, and obviously they're going to spread their wings, and it will be a good fit. And I think from the people at the Inchcape sites, assuming that they're all okay. It works for them as well, because they've probably had a worrying time with all the sort of the news that Inchcape's going more and more down the distribution route. So yeah, I think it works for everybody, and it's an interesting fit, and probably quite reassuring that it's a company like that that's buying them. So yeah, it's all good news, and yeah, fascinating times to come in that retail world, because yeah, some have already been sold, and more will undoubtedly be sold.
I think part of why we didn't see it coming as well is they've Group One have traditionally bought sort of little local groups. So I mean, they've bought like your Barons and your Beadles and all these companies, whereas this is undoubtedly the biggest thing they've bought, I think. Anyway, I'm gone through the numbers, but it certainly looks like the biggest thing they've bought. So I suppose that's why we didn't see it coming. I mean, going back to Jack's piece, it is definitely worth a read. Obviously, we would say that, but it is worth a read, because there's some really great tidbits and quotes in there. Separate to this, there's a quote in there about the Alfa Auto acquisition of Lookers, which caught my eye as well. So I think it's Steve Young is quoted here. He was sort of saying some of the benefits of a US business acquiring a UK business. One of the things is it doesn't cause the same concerns to manufacturers as a UK group acquiring another group would do. But that doesn't apply to the Alfa Auto acquisition of Lookers, which does not fit this mold, he says. The nature of that business is very different, and I still think we could see some fallout from that deal. Much has happened when Constellation acquired Marshall. So Steve Young there pointing to perhaps the road might be a bit rocky for Lookers and their manufacturer relationships as time goes by. Will that be the case? We will see. Watch this space.
Yes. Shall I move us on?
Yes, before I indict us in some sort of lawsuit. Yes, go on.
Well, another absolutely sensational story was revealed this week. I think I alluded to it on the podcast last week. I can't remember because I didn't listen back to it, because I can't stand listening to my voice. But I think...
How do you watch old Top Gear?
Oh, very funny. Very funny. I think I alluded to this last week. Essentially, at the back end of last week, there were mutterings. Well, not mutterings, but you know, there was a story going around. The Italian government wasn't very happy at Alfa Romeo, and the reason for their displeasure was that their Alfa Romeo's new first bespoke electric car might have broken Italian law. Now, the car in question is the Milano. And of course, Milano is a very sacred name for Alfa Romeo, because of course, that's where the company was founded. Milan, that is. And so obviously this is a groundbreaking new car for Alfa Romeo, their first electric car, the step into the future for them. And hence why they've called it Milano. But whilst this story was sort of rumored last week, it became true this week. And the Italian government have actually said, you are breaking Italian law for naming this car Milano. And the reason for that is Italy has this rule that if you're going to name a product after an Italian city or an Italian area, it has to be from that area. And the Milano is not built in Milan. It is built at Stellantis's plant in Poland. So Alfa Romeo have had to do a very sudden U-turn. And essentially overnight, they've changed the name to Junior. And I know for a fact that Alfa Romeo are hosting UK media at the moment, and they've been invited out there to do these walk-around videos of the new car. And of course, they've been invited under the assumption it's going to be called Milano. They've turned up to the studio, and there are, you know, people from Alfa Romeo removing the Milano number plates and hastily putting Junior number plates on the car. An absolutely staggering story, this, and I'm amazed that nobody at Stellantis sort of had planned potentially for this to happen. And of course, you've got to remember the amount of money that goes into launching a car, and not only launching the car, but for the past few months, Alfa Romeo have been teasing us with announcements that this car was going to be called Milano. So I'm frankly staggered that this has happened. And it seems to be the latest step in Italy really sort of tightening its muscles on this kind of thing. There have been various things like this in the past. The most recent has been Prosecco. The Italian government have clamped down on that, saying, look, if you're going to call Italian sparkling wine Prosecco, it needs to be from the Prosecco region. And also Parmigiano Reggiano, the delicious cheese, which we all put on our pastas, has got to come from that area. So
what you're saying, Badge, Alfa Romeos have to be from Milan if they're going to be called Alfa Romeos. Otherwise, it's just a sparkling Fiat.
It's just a sparkling Fiat from Poland. Yes. A quite staggering story. I mean, did you find this quite mad as well?
Yeah, well, one of my favourite bits, and James, who's again sitting on his sofa listening to this, has asked me to point out that almost the best bit about it was the press release that came through shortly after this happened, where they changed the name, and it's just titled Alfa Romeo : Milano name is not okay, Junior then. That's the title of the press release. Okay, we changed the name. It's fine. And then it goes
Was that Italian accent? Was that Italian accent?
I haven't been to Italy for some time, Batch. ish.
Stellantis have come, they fought back on this because immediately the Alfa Romeo boss spoke to Autocar and did a very clever pivot on all of this, because he said that the Italian government should stop worrying about what cars are named after and actually be supporting the country and the car industry in Italy. So there's definitely a war going on here, and it seems like a war at the moment that Stellantis has lost. But you do have to sort of agree with Alfa Romeo here that the Italian government seems to be a little bit too worried about what cars are called, as opposed to
whether they'll make any cars in the next 20 years if the Chinese arrive. Yeah, exactly.
Precisely.
There was an interesting part of that interview as well, where he talked about why it's not made in Italy. And the point was, we'd love to make cars in Italy, but, you know, we're all working to a budget. This is an electric car. We have to go where the platform is being made. And that Stellantis platform is made in Poland. So that's where what you have to do. You'd love to set up a production line in Milan or wherever, but there's just not the money to do that. But he did point out as well, the next generation of Giulia, I don't know if you said this about the Stelvio as well, will be made in Italy, as they are at the moment, I think. So they're certainly not disappearing out of Italy altogether. And frankly, when you look at Stellantis' brands, it's amazing that they are still making Alfa Romeos at all, or Nazis, because the volume mix is pretty small, and they've got so many premium. Okay, we're not going to have an argument about what's better, a DS or an Alfa Romeo, but they've got so many brands. It's just a bit much. The other thing I ask Darren what he thinks is the Italian government seem to be doing this on the basis that nothing can be called Milano unless it's made in Milan. I'm pretty sure if you walk into a furniture shop, any furniture shop in the UK, DFS, whatever, there will be a sofa called Milano, which is definitely not made in Milan. It's made on an industrial estate in Sheffield somewhere. So surely, is it just because it's Alfa Romeo that this applies to, or are they going to hunt down everyone using the word Milano or Milan or Torino or whatever?
I think if I were the boss of Alfa Romeo, if I were intending to build the Giulia and the Stelvio in Italy, the next generations of those cars, out of spite, I would call them after Polish towns. And I don't know any Polish towns, but that's my research for the next
Alfa Romeo,
7 days. Yes. So that's what I would do. But, you know, luckily I'm not in control of a car company. So,
Darren, what are your thoughts?
The Alfa Romeo Gdansk has a good ring to it, I think. Yeah.
Darren.
Plucks that one out there. Or Krakow. The Alfa Romeo Krakow, maybe not so much, but
No, perhaps not. No.
I suppose what surprises me is that these companies don't do their due diligence beforehand. They obviously do due diligence on it, but I mean it's like the Aura with the funky cat, isn't it? Having to rename that further down the line after they've launched it, and it's just it is a bit of a strange one. You'd have thought that being obviously Italian, Alfa Romeo would have been able to have a conversation with the government there and try and persuade them, but I guess rules are rules, and they're probably a stickler for them. But it's just a bit. It's strange that they got down so far down the route. I mean, they've launched it pretty much, didn't they? Just the video on YouTube, and then on the 10th of April or something, then they change it a few days later. It's incredible, and I think the name Junior. I know it's got history, but you go back that sort of 60s and 70s. Does anyone know about that history? It doesn't really compare with Milano, does it? The Alfa Romeo Junior doesn't really encourage you particularly. So yeah, I guess it's a bit of red faces for them, but they'll crack on. But as you say, it's probably low volume here anyway. So yeah, but yeah, the Alfa Romeo Gdansk, I think, is a really great idea, and I might trademark that one.
You heard it here first. Yeah.
We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Okay, I will move. Is it me? It is me. No, it's you. Yes, it's me. Good.
No, it's you.
We're all late today. Okay, I'm going to just touch on British Volt, which is the slightly disastrous attempt at building a battery factory in the northeast of England, which seemed like a fantastic idea. It's not really gone too well. So I don't really need to go over the history of this, but I will anyway. So they proposed to build a £3.8 billion gigafactory, which is a word I hate because I don't think it means anything, a gigafactory, up in Blythe. That didn't really happen. I think they started building the sites, there was lots of investment, and then it all collapsed. So we've now got a situation where there's this large amount of, well, half dug up land ripe for being used for something. Sadly, it doesn't appear to be turning into a battery plant, because it's now been announced that it's going to be used for one of Europe's largest data centers, which is, to the uninitiated, a big room full of lots of servers where things are stored, like our website, for example, which people have pointed out is not really going to bring the same level of jobs as a battery plant, because servers tend to just sort of exist and get on with things. I mean, it's, you know, obviously it will have some sort of sales, some sort of workforce, but not to the same level that a battery plant will, which is very sad. There will be construction jobs and so on. But the other thing is, the other element of this is, we still don't have a battery plant, which is an incredibly important thing. I mean, we have little ones here and there, obviously, don't we? We have Tata are building one in the southwest. We've got Nissan have got one up in Sunderland next to their plants. But this doesn't seem to be working as a proposition, does it? A third party, you know, British Volty type battery plant doesn't seem to be working as an option.
Yeah, I know. It's you know, the whole thing has been a farce, hasn't it? I mean, this British Volt fiasco has sort of rumbled on and what have you. And I think you've got to look at the wider picture here, which is it just doesn't say a lot about Britain and its capacity to actually support this whole green transition. You know, if we can't get things like this across the line, what hope do we have in actually fully transitioning to electric cars? I know that's quite a, you know, a a triggering thing to say, I know, but I think you just got to look at the wider, and I hate this word, optics, which is, you know, that we just haven't got a chance here of properly supporting companies who wish to build electric cars in this country and potentially in the future as well, if we can't get the infrastructure side right. Now, I'm not just talking about electric car charging, but things like batteries, motors, trying to localize production. We need to be localizing production, because to fully support making our car industry greener and kinder to the environment, we can't be making batteries in far corners of the world and shipping them across. We need to be making them where the cars are being made. So, unfortunately, this story doesn't surprise me, because the whole thing has been a bit of a farce, hasn't it, over the past few years. But the wider picture, it feeds into this wider picture, and it's not a good picture, I don't think, at the moment.
I don't really know much about the intricacies of battery production and the costs of doing so, but it does seem surprising that we can't find anyone to actually do it. I don't know if it's just labour costs here or something, but, you know, with rules of origin, we need to have batteries made here, don't we, if we're actually going to have cars built here.
Yeah.
So you would think there is a business case for it, but maybe it's just an issue with the way technology moves on, the speed of change with all these things. I don't know. But very sad.
Yeah, I know. And I know this is a bit of a sort of a slightly sort of petulant thing to say, but what do countries like China think about this? You know, we just can't even sort ourselves out here. And yet in the time that it has probably taken for this British Volt operation to actually start up, I bet the Chinese car industry has built 60 different factories. You know, it's exporting cars all around the world. And I think we just look absolutely ridiculous to countries in the Far East who are making great strides in this area.
Darren,
improving their battery technology as they go as well. So we haven't even set up yet, and they're getting better and better at it. So we're kind of people maybe moan about the Far East coming over here with the product, but it's great product and they're doing it, and we're not particularly so, or not in enough volume. So yeah, it's we kind of do need that infrastructure, but yeah, I don't know the intricacies about why it all fell through, but it's something is needed, but it probably needs the government to assist with that as well. But plenty of opportunities as EVs grow with the ZEV mandate. We're not far off needing 50% of registrations to be EVs, aren't we? So if we can get some batteries produced over here, then it's got to help. But feels like we're light years away from that.
Sadly so. Over to Bat. Yes.
Well, let's stick with the battery theme and stick with the Chinese theme, actually. It's almost like we've planned this, which we really do not plan this every single week at all.
I think they know that by now, believe me.
That's obvious, James.
Yeah, all right, okay, all right, fine. So we heard this week that GWM Aura, they've launched an in-house EV battery inspection and evaluation program. Now, before everybody falls asleep and goes to make a cup of tea, this is quite a thing, actually. It caught my eye, hence why I wrote about it. So GWM Aura, which, as we know, is part of IM, International Motors, here in the UK, who, of course, also is the name behind Isuzu and Subaru.
Good brand.
Pardon?
Good brand.
Yes.
Subaru. Carry on.
Yes, very good brand. they're going to be using their pretty sizable network across the UK to have these little teams who are going to be, well, their after sales teams, who are going to give a bit of assistance, field-based assistance, it's called, to sort of evaluate and give sort of a verdict on EV batteries. Now, at the moment, which happens quite often, and a lot more than I thought, actually, if an EV is involved in an accident, quite a lot of EVs, and that's quite a general thing to say, I know, but you know, a sizable proportion of EVs are written off. because there are fears that the battery and the electric car powertrain has been damaged, and potentially damaged to a point that is irreparable, and insurance deems it to be, insurance company deems it to be a write-off. But GWM Aura, and I've heard this from other people as well, quite often in these cases, cars are written off. Electric cars are written off, and there's actually no damage to the battery or to the powertrain whatsoever. It's just an assumption that the car is damaged. There's obviously fears about working on electric cars and batteries, you know, high voltage systems, and it's just easier just to write the car off. So GWM Aura are creating this team to actually go around and properly look at these cars if they are involved in an accident, and to work out whether they can be repaired as opposed to just being written off. So I think this is the first time I'm perfectly happy to be corrected on this, but I think this is the first time I've heard a company or a car maker doing this, actually setting up a dedicated team for this. And it's something which I think needs to happen more and more, especially as more electric cars are going to be sold in the UK.
Yeah, I think the only thing I'm aware of that's not really similar is Volvo looking at crashes and then analysing. You know, Volvo come out and like to analyse how the car did in the crash, don't they, for the benefit of crash testing. That's something they do. That's for different reasons, and it's not to get the car back on the road again. But yeah, I thought this was good as well, because, I mean, anecdotally, I am in a Nissan Leaf owners group on Facebook.
Oh my word, you're happy to announce that to the world?
I'm coming out as a Nissan Leaf owners group member here. But what I do see, occasionally on there, is someone's had a minor prang, let's say. Someone's had a van going to the back of them and the back bumper's dented, and maybe there's a little bit of metal work needs doing, and the car is written off. And the owners are buying them back because it's the value that the insurance company has put on them after being written off is so small. That they're able to do that because they think, well, hang on, I like this car and it's not really damaged and I've owned it since, you know, it's 2 years old or whatever. I can see it's perfectly safe and I'm happy to do that. But it does seem like, yeah, there's a propensity to just go, nah, write it off. I don't know if that's just Nissan Leafs, which are predominantly quite cheap at this point, you know, the older ones. But yeah, I can imagine this is a real thing. I mean, also anecdotally, I was talking about insurance yesterday, and somebody with an EV told me their EV insurance was much more than their petrol car insurance. I'm not sure if that's the case across the board. But I'm sure there is a problem. I mean, we talk about it with servicing as well, don't we? There's, servicing and repairs and so on. There's accreditation that needs to happen for EVs, which is not happening at quite the rate that it should be. Mm. So, yeah, I think it's good. And it can only help the values.
Yeah, I think Darren, I think, yeah, I know, very good. But before we talk about values, I was just going to say, I think there is a kind of an anti-EV kind of thing. Anything to do with an EV, there seems to be a bit of negativity around it, don't you think, Darren? And, any opportunity to sort of slag off EVs or to financially sort of penalise people having an EV, it seems to be happening, doesn't it?
It feels like you're either in one camp or the other with EVs. You're either an advocate or you kind of, I'm never touching one. And there's obviously a lot of EV bashing out there in various quarters. But I think if you've had one, you a lot of people tend to love them. Although, speaking to someone who lives in London, who's got one, and like they probably won't, they're not impressed to get another one. But these are coming. They're coming, and in 10 years' time, we'll probably. The vast majority of us will have one, and the vast majority of dealers have got to sell them. And anything that can be done, I think this is a great initiative. And I'd imagine that the main reason is to get the insurance costs down, because insurance is high on them. But anything that can help with that is sort of away from asking the government to do stuff to stimulate demand, it is a good thing. So you do hear lots of stories about them being written off. So just because of the battery being an enclosed unit, and I guess there's technicians as well that have got to be retrained on EV. So sometimes it's probably just easier. But whilst volumes are low, it's probably okay for the insurers to decide on that route. But once volumes increase, is that a viable thing to be doing? It doesn't sound like it to me. So yeah, I think it's a really good initiative by GWM.
Surprising move for an importer to do it as well, because they're not, a wholly owned subsidiary or anything. It'd be different if, I don't know, Renault turned around and did it or something, but.
Yeah, I think the companies that are coming in though, they realise they've got to fit in with the UK. You look at sort of BYD and using or going with like established dealer networks and that type of thing. That has to be the way forward, really, I think, for these companies. And they have to do a lot of marketing, and any sort of good news with regards to that will help them, because the ordinary man in the street probably hasn't really heard of them, and that's one of their biggest challenges that these sort of specialist EV brands or the new incumbents have got. So anything they can do like this in their local area as well, getting good news stories out there, or partnering with renowned companies, I think really helps those brands.
You know what? It wouldn't surprise me if this was all to do with insurance, as we've been saying as well, because it just occurred to me, International Motors, Subaru, if you go and buy a Subaru today, it will still have a little fitted keypad in it, like a Thatcham Category 1 alarm in it. This is certainly the case when I had a Subaru press car a year ago, like you used to get in the 90s to protect your Subaru Impreza from being nicked, because they were the Range Rover of being nicked of the 1990s, weren't they, Subaru Impressors? So it wouldn't surprise me if that is still in IM's mind of insurance prices. How can we get them down? There we go. I'll move us on, shall we?
Jeez.
I've opened the wrong tab. I'm going to keep it with battery electric vehicles. What a shock. But it's news from
Dear, dear.
CAPHPI. Don't know if you've heard of them. CAPHPI have reckoned sales of battery electric vehicles are poised to hit 414,000 in 2024. That's compared to a figure of 439,000 for new petrol registrations. So very much reaching similar levels. Doesn't quite feel like that sat here, but that is apparently what is going to happen. So there's a Similarly, there's a considerable decline in upper medium vehicles from 45% to 30% of all UK battery electric vehicle sales, and an increase in smaller cars from 20% of the mix to 30%. So some interesting movements going on in the battery electric sector over the next 12 months, well, over the next 9 months, I suppose. I mean, it feels rude of me to go, Darren, tell us more about this, because this is not actually from your kind of your wheelhouse as such. But I thought that was a really surprising stat to see, because we sit here thinking how a manufacturer is going to hit there, and I'm sure lots of manufacturers are going to have this problem of hitting their 22%. But that seems like a wave of EVs are coming towards us.
Yeah, but it's all, well, we're told by the SMT, Darren, that it's all fleets and businesses, aren't we?
Yeah. So a lot of it is fleet and business. Within that fleet and business number is salary sacrifice now. So that is arguably retail. And we haven't found a way of trimming those figures out. So that's part of the reason why. But it does remain that the incentives are there for the company car driver, but not for the ordinary man in the street. So that's why companies are going down that route. Motability are very popular as well in the EV world with manufacturers, because they've obviously got a customer base there already, and they can mop up those vehicles. So yeah, it kind of makes sense. That number is still, I mean, if we hit sort of 2 million registrations this year, that's still not at that 22%. And bearing in mind
True.
that Tesla are 100%, and so are a few other companies, then there are a lot of manufacturers that are very, very low with their EV content. I think Ford, something like 3%. And that's obviously, they've got a plan, and they don't have to pay those fines at the end of this year. They've just got to show that they've got a plan for the ZEV mandate. But those fines at £15,000 per vehicle are horrendous. So they've got to think of a way of getting out of that. But yeah, it's interesting on the size of the vehicles that there's more people interested in a small SU, sorry, a small EV. So you kind of think that works as maybe your second car. And that could be the way of getting people into EVs. Switch your little city car or your super mini and getting into a smaller one. But it's, I mean, as I said at the start, it's fascinating. It's incredible that all we talk about is EVs, and there's such a small part of the market still. But it is what everybody wants to talk to us about, and that's where the volatility is in the forecasting side as well. So people buying EVs now, they want to speak to us about sort of a confidence rating for our forecasts for those sorts of vehicles. And it is a lot more difficult to sort of judge those, because who knows, with technology moving on, all of that type of thing. So it's we're seeing loads more data on the sold side, more than double each month the cars that were sold last year. So they are selling in the used market as well. But as I say, we need more sort of stimulation to get them get more of these cars. I always say this, every new car needs a used car buyer 2, 3 years down the line, or however long it is. So all of these cars that are registered to fleets now, in 3 years' time, they're coming back into the used car market. And at that point in time, in 3 years, what are the new car incentives going to be like? How are you going to encourage a new car buyer into one? Consumers are interested in them, but I mean, you all probably have conversations with people about EVs. Do they want one now, or are they just kicking it down the road a little bit because they don't need one at the moment? So it's a fascinating area, and obviously, we've done that piece. I wasn't involved in it myself, but certainly the best article on your website by a million miles, John. So no, I'm joking. It is a really interesting area.
I mean, from a values point of view, I don't know how I won't ask how long you've been in your CapHPI job, but so the type of incentives we're getting on retail EVs at the minute, is that have we seen anything like that on petrol and diesel cars going back, apart from, the odd occasional thing where they've got too many Citroën C5s or something and they need to shift them all? Like the amount of money that's being taken off these cars, 7.5 grand deposit contributions and so on. I mean, is this a unique to EV situation, or is this something that we saw back in the good old days of really pushing and discounting and so on?
I think back in, I mean, I've been in the job here 11 years. Prior to that, I was 17 years at Vauxhall, so I've kind of seen a bit of discounting in my time as well
I was
there.
going to say, no discounting.
The discounting used to be a little bit more pre-reg, and selling cars to sort of fleets and rental and that type of thing. So rental was always a good outlet to sell cars if you had a problem. These retail deals, yeah, they're not unprecedented, but they're probably a little bit more noticeable because they're being advertised to try and encourage people into them. There would be sort of what they call pack cars being sold to dealers, where so the dealer would register them themselves and then sell them as like a nearly new car with like 0 miles. So that was the sort of thing that probably went on a little bit more previously, although we are seeing an increase in pre-reg activity. And obviously, more cars are going into the rental industry as well now. And if the rental companies want EVs, then they can probably have as many as they want at the moment. So there's different ways of skinning the cat, really, with regards to that. But yeah, I mean, we've seen some hefty discounts. All I would say is that on those discounts, a lot of those EVs, used EVs, their prices, because they've dropped so much, like 50 odd percent on average over the last 18 months, they're so far away from the list prices that sometimes those heavy discounts don't necessarily affect the used car prices as much as they maybe would have done in the past. If you're taking 8 grand off a new car, plus we've sort of hit you see 8 grand off plus dealer discount as well, making it sort of 15, 16 grand off that. Sometimes those used car prices are so far away from the new car that it won't have as much of an impact. But if you see that advertised, you're still going to think, well, I'm going to go and buy a new one if you want a new one. But it does remain that fleet is still the way forward for the OEMs to try and reach those ZEV mandate targets. Even if you knock 8 grand off a Honda EY N1, how many are they going to sell of those? Really, it's still not going to be enough volume probably to hit those really difficult ZEV targets. I think something needs to be done with the ZEV mandate personally, rather than all of this heavy discounting, because manufacturers don't make fortunes on any cars anymore, and they don't make fortunes on EVs. So if they're discounting to those levels to hit their targets, it's a really difficult position for them to be in.
Yeah, kind of loss leading, aren't they, really? I mean, Batch, you speak to car manufacturers left, right, and centre. You have spoken to me vaguely about one who was not going to hit their target, but we're going to just concentrate on CO2 instead.
And there are, like Darren said, there are ways around this 22%. But I suppose this is a bit of an extreme thing to say. But you know, if manufacturers aren't making a huge amount of money on their cars, are we making the UK a difficult place for car manufacturers to sell cars in? It does sort of cross my mind that some car makers, particularly the smaller ones, might think, you know, it already costs a lot of money to make a car right-hand drive. And yes, I know there are other right-hand drive markets around the world, but the UK already has slightly different, you know, circumstances to you know, continental Europe and wherever. So all of a sudden, if you're making it even harder for car makers to make money on their cars, they could very well turn around and say, do you know what? The UK is just too difficult. We're going to focus on other countries. So it is an interesting time. It really is.
What we're opening ourselves up to with that theory is the Chinese brands coming in, isn't it? Because they can.
Well, exactly.
You look at what they're selling the cars for here, and you look at what they're selling the same cars for in their own country, and they can afford to discount even with the distribution and the transport costs. They can still afford to reduce the prices. So the pressure is on the incumbents over here with those brands coming in. Yeah. And the harder we make it, then that is difficult. You look at that ZEV mandate, and one thing we've got our eye on is that between 2027 and 2028, there's a 14% increase in the share that they've got to get. That's when it goes from 38% to 52%. And that's over half of the cars, and that's not that far away now. So it's very tricky there. And we're obviously going to get a change of government. Can't imagine that if there's a new government that comes in, that they're going to want to change that straight away. So it's a really tricky area for the OEMs. And I imagine that they're struggling. I'm glad I'm not a Vauxhall anymore anyway, put it that way. Glad I'm doing what I'm doing now.
Well, on that note, Darren, before we ask for your verdict, are there any? I'm assuming you don't have any more stories, Batch.
We've
reached our time limit. That's good. Are there any stories, Darren, you think we should have talked about this week that we haven't?
I quite like the story about Qashqai with the new model coming out. Obviously, it's a volume vehicle for the really important vehicle for the UK as well. So it's quite interesting to read that. I think they've had some good press coverage over it. And it's a really high volume vehicle now. The days of obviously the Fiesta and the Corsa dominating the registration figures are long gone. So I thought, so that was probably one that stood out to me. Apart from that, I think you've covered most of the story. It's been quite a busy week for various things, but again, a lot of it's dominated by EV again, isn't it? The stories of the week.
The thing about Qashqai for me, sorry, I know we're trying to wrap up, but I knew there was a facelift coming, but it still took me by surprise because I still think of the current Qashqai as still being a new car. When I see one on the road, I think, oh, it's a new Qashqai over there. And I don't know why I think that. But for me, updating the Qashqai, I mean, it has been on sale for about 3 years now, hasn't it? But it was still a bit of a surprise because I still think it was a new car. But perhaps that's just me. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I didn't think it really needed updating. But I think it's mostly a light tweak to the outside, isn't it? It's not. They haven't touched the inside much. That looks the same. No. That's still perfect.
That's obviously a good thing that you think it's quite still new as well, because it obviously looks relatively fresh. For a volume model, obviously, it's got a following. But it's interesting to see the new one anyway. From our point of view, volume models are really important to us. So we obviously deal with the niche stuff, but the volume is the bread and butter, isn't it? So.
Absolutely. So I'm going to have to ask you, who chose the best stories, or what is your story of the week?
I think I used to get accused of always voting for Becca, so I'm going to vote for her again, if that's all right. But
Well, she did write the Nissan story. So
she did, yeah. Yes, I've just seen that, actually, yeah.
Conveniently enough, she's on next week, so I could just hand that over to her.
I think, for me, probably the most interesting story was the why the UK for US investors. But obviously, because John, you've mentioned the CAP HPI story, I'm going to 100% vote for you as the winner. So, and all bias is definitely there. So, but yeah, you've definitely won.
Who could have seen that coming?
Unbelievable.
Unprecedented.
You should have thought of that, James. You should have gone with your first story, CAP HPI. I could have given you the trophy and we could have all finished this call 45 minutes ago.
I hadn't noted it down, but I just thought I didn't want to go straight in with a CAP HPI story. But I've obviously got a lot to learn on this.
Well, on that note, all that's left for me to say is thank you to Darren for judging today. It's been lovely to have you on and always good to get your insight. And of course, we'll be joining you again next week, not for the podcast, but for a separate video, I'm sure, or a separate story with
Right,
some
yeah,
other
thanks. Thanks for
people.
inviting me back on.
Anytime, anytime. And thank you to Batch as well. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, take a look in the show notes below or head to cardinalmagazine.co.uk. If you'd like to give us a rating or tell your friends about how excellent this podcast is, by all means do that. And if you'd like to buy a brown Nissan Note, head over to the Clever Car Collection, where James is more than happy to sell you one from his sofa. Thanks for listening and goodbye.